Episode 16, You Be the Judge. Nelson had worked very hard to learn Hilchos Shechita, and by now he was confident that he knew it quite well. For a final review, before he was ready to test it, he hired a veteran shechet to learn Hilchos Shechita with him for 30 days. The question is, do the days of Shabbos, when they did not learn with one another, count in the number of 30 days to be learned with each other? Or do we say that the shechet owes time to Nelson for all those additional days from within the 30 days? The answer, the Ramah writes in Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, that although the shofar is blown at the conclusion of davening throughout the entire month of Elul, however, Erev Rosh Hashanah, the shofar is not blown. The Vilna Gaon, on his commentary on Sefer Yonah, Gimel Gimel, explains that since the shofar is supposed to awaken a person to do tshuva, as the Pasuk tells us in Amos, Gimel Ches, Aye Sha'ag, Mila Yira, a lion has roared, who will not fear it? If the shofar were to be blown consecutively for 30 days, it would no longer be effective to wake a person on Rosh Hashanah. A precedent to this concept is found in Maseches Gittin, where the Gemara tells us a mosquito entered the brain of the Roman general Titus and began pecking incessantly, giving him no respite. One day, as Titus passed by a blacksmith shop, he noticed that the noise of the hammering calmed the mosquito's activity. Titus hired a blacksmith to sit and hammer in his presence so that the mosquito would no longer torment him. After hearing the hammering for 30 days, the mosquito became accustomed to the background noise and renewed its vigorous, intense pecking. Hence, we see from this Gemara that if a person becomes accustomed to hearing the shofar for 30 consecutive days, its sound now becomes rote and ineffective. Therefore, we do not blow the shofar on the last day of Elul. Someone pointed out to Reb Chaim Kanievsky Zatzal that in any event, the shofar is not blown for 30 consecutive days since we don't blow it on Shabbos. Reb Chaim explained that according to the Vilna Gaon's opinion, if someone had said V'sein Talmud Mutar for 30 days, he can then assume that he has made the bracha correctly, even if he did not consciously do so, because it's muscle retention. This is despite the fact that one does not say V'sein Talmud Mutar on Shabbos. Nevertheless, Shabbos is included in the quote-unquote 30 days, even if in fact one said V'sein Talmud Mutar for only 26 out of 30. According to this logic, we see one could become accustomed to hearing shofar over a 30-day period, even if the shofar is not blown on Shabbos. Perhaps all of this would apply to our question as well. Even if the shechet learned with Nelson for quote-unquote 30 days and they did not learn on Shabbos, that is the 30-day period, and that's included in their agreement, which would be sufficient. However, one could argue and say the cases are not similar at all. Although one can establish a routine over the course of 30 days, and Shabbos does not detract from one's habitual behavior, that does not determine if Shabbos is included, even if he does not teach on Shabbos when one has been hired to teach for quote-unquote 30 days. The Shilta Gibarim Baba Kama Mem Aleph, in the pages of the Rif, discusses whether Shabbos and Yontif are included in a 30-day count when Bezin would say that they would need 30 days to carry out its decision. The relevance of this issue is for those activities that are prohibited on Shabbos. For example, paying sums of money, cutting down a tree that disturbs the public. The Shilta Gibarim writes that it appears to him that Shabbos and Yontif are included in the 30-day period, even though technically those items may not be done on Shabbos. He compares this to someone who's hired on a monthly basis on work that although technically cannot be done on Shabbos, yet he's paid for the entire month, including Shabbos. He's not required to work for those extra days at the end of the month to make up for all those Shabbos days that he did not work. However, you could say, this might apply only to jobs that cannot be performed on Shabbos. One is allowed to learn Hilchos Shabbos, Hilchos Shechita on Shabbos. Perhaps in such a case, if the two did not learn on Shabbos, Shabbos is not included in those 30 days, and now the missing days must be made up. It would seem that halacha in this case should be decided whatever the prevailing minhag custom is. The minhag seems to be that when someone is hired for a period of 30 days, the intent is with the exception of Shabbos, and Shabbos is not deducted from the 30-day count, and therefore a person would need to make up those days because they need to know Hilchos Shechita. So it depends on the minhag. Question number two. Among the requirements for a shliach tzibur for the Yom HaNeraim, Shulchan Aruch says that one should be at least 30 years of age. The question is the following. A kollel consists of young married men. None have reached the age of 30 yet. The candidates of Shliach Tzibur are at most in their 20s. Here's the question. Is there any advantage of choosing someone who's over 20, or once they don't have a chazan who's 30 years old, it's acceptable for them to choose an 18-year-old chazan once they don't have that number anyways? The answer was given, the Rambam, Hilchos Klei Mikdash, Hey Tesvav, rules that once a kohen has reached maturity, he's technically capable of serving the Beis HaMikdash. Brothers, the Kohanim would not allow anyone who is not yet 20 years old to fulfill that capacity. The Chazaras HaShatz of Musaf and Rosh Hashanah contains the Karbanos that were brought in the Beis HaMikdash. Is this a reason that someone younger than 20 should be prevented from filling the capacity of serving as Chazan? Or maybe this is only specifically a stringency that would apply only to a Kohen to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, but not a Shliach Tzibur. In this, the Sefer Gur'ar Yehuda and Mayadim Chof notes that although the Rambam cites the limitation of a Kohen serving the Beis HaMikdash before the age of 20, he makes no such limitation in the laws of Tefillah. This would imply that there is no such particularity in the regard to Shliach Tzibur. On the other hand, the Gur'ar Yehuda cites a Yerushalmi in Maseches Sukkah Gimel Yud Beis regarding a child who knows how to shake a lulav. Although he has an obligation to take a lulav, he may not be the chazan until he has physical maturation. Rebbe said that he would have to be 20 years of age. As the Pasuk says, Vayamidu Salavim ben Esrim Shana Vamala. Specifically, they stationed Levi, who was aged 20 years and older, Linatseach Amalachas Beis Hashem, to direct the words of the Beis Hashem. According to Rebbe, one should be particular that a chazan must be at least 20 years old. Moreover, the Sharidea writes that someone who is younger than 20 should not be the Shliach Tzibur for Musaf, as according to the opinion of Rav Avadim Bar Tanuro, one who is younger than 20 is pater from the Machtzah Shekel, which was used to purchase communal sacrifices. Since Musaf corresponds to the Karban Musaf, one who is exempt from the Karban Musaf, meaning he is younger than 20, cannot discharge others' obligation by serving as their chazan. This idea was precedented by those who opined that women are exempt from davening Musaf, just as they are exempt from giving the Machtzah Shekel. However, many Peskim disagree with this opinion, among them the Ber Yitzchok, Tzitz Eliezer, Mishas Yavetz, and others. Nevertheless, if there are two candidates for the Chazan and both are equal in all the prerequisites, if one of them is also 20 years or older, he should be chosen in deference to the stringent opinions. However, another fact to consider that is if one candidate was older than 25, perhaps he should be the preferred choice, as we find that Levium actually began their service at the age of 25, and therefore Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein left it as Vitzarachian. One more question. A very special Talmud Chacham who had served as the Baal Tekeah in Rosh Hashanah was Nifter, leaving behind two sons. Assuming that each of the sons would want to inherit their father's position as Baal Tekeah, the Rav of the town was concerned this might create a bitter machlekes between them. In order to avoid this rift, the Rav informed them that he personally would assume the position as the new Baal Tekeah. People in the community were quite upset because they felt that the sons should have at least brought their case before a Beis Din to decide which of the son would be the one to assume their father's place. Why should the Rav deprive one son from carrying on the father's position? The question is, did the Rav act properly by avoiding this machlokes? To answer this, the Maral Diskin discusses the pasuk where it says, in Parshas Bishalach, Vayikach Moshe es atzmeis Yosef yimai. Moshe took the bones of Yosef with him. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu take Yosef HaTzadik's coffin with him? Why didn't he leave it to the task of Yosef's grandchildren, that of the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh? Just as every tribe took the coffin of their ancestors, why is Yosef's family deprived of this? On this, the Maral Diskin explains that since each of Yosef's sons had become his own shevet, a machlekes could have erupted between them who would be the shevet to carry their grandfather Yosef HaTzadik's coffin. Therefore, in order to avoid this dispute, Moshe Rabbeinu preempted this possibility by personally taking Yosef's coffin. This diuk enlightens us that the Rav was indeed correct to avoid any possibility of strife between the sons of the Talmud Chacham by taking the mitzvah for himself. This is especially so since there are some opinions that mitzvahs do not transfer to one's children through inheritance. One could argue that our case is not similar to the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, as Moshe Rabbeinu is preventing machlekes between two shvatim, which would constitute a national tragedy. The Maral Diskin explains the connection between the two psukim v'chamushim olu b'nei Yisrael, that the b'nei Yisrael were armed when they went out Meretz Mitzrayim, v'yikach Moshe es atzmeis Yosef, juxtaposing that Moshe took out the bones of Yosef with him, based that Klal Yisrael girded themselves with five types of weapons from Mitzrayim. Moshe was concerned that now that they were armed, a civil war potentially could erupt. Because this was such a volatile situation, Moshe Rabbeinu knew he had to take matter into his own hands and take Yosef's coffin with him. However, in our two brothers' case, although there may have been a possibility of machlekes, it would never approach the level of a civil war between two tribes. And another difference between the cases is that the children of Yosef at Tzadik did not have a claim that the mitzvah was already theirs, as the mitzvah only became relevant only at that time. In addition, when Moshe Rabbeinu retrieved Yosef's coffin, it was certainly a greater honor for Yosef than had his descendants taken it with them. Therefore, Ephraim and Manasseh yield to Moshe and allowed him to seize the mitzvah that otherwise would have been fallen to them. In our case, the departed Baal Tekeah already had a claim that this was his mitzvah, and many Poskim do maintain that mitzvahs do pass via Yerusha inheritance. In that case, it would be unjust to wrest the mitzvah from the sons. The Poskim discuss at length if there is Yerusha in regard to mitzvahs in case where there's a machlekes between the heirs. The Avnei Nezer maintains that even if there is a machlekes, the heirs still have a claim to the Yerusha. However, the Chikrei Lev's opinion is there is no claim of Yerusha of a mitzvah in a case where there is machlekes. As a matter of practice, further study is necessary regarding each individual situation, and therefore one should consult their local Orthodox rabbi. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day.